Welcome to the Arts and Antique Radio Show, where your host, nationally recognized certified appraiser Elizabeth Stewart, Santa Barbara's treasure sleuth, will help you put a value on the treasures in your own home.
Every time it rains, pennies from heaven. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So let's find out. How valuable is it?
Hello, 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 Santa Barbara. It's your chantress of everything valuable and beautiful, Elizabeth Stewart. And we've got a little bit of a mixed bag and a treat. I have Dale Griffith Stamos with me. We've introduced her before on this program. She's a filmmaker, and I've covered a number of her films. She's got a film that will be premiering. And I heard about it, and I thought, ooh, this is a topic I mean, women of a certain age are just going to love this film. And it involves sort of an older woman, younger man kind of romance that's got a lot of tension involved. And of course, everybody's beautiful. And it's complex because it happens in a setting that is supposed to be free of any kind of sexual tension at all, and that's, you know, university setting. So that is something that I've thought about a lot. I was a very mature graduate student and doctoral candidate. I was older than some of my professors, you know, at the time, Dale, and thought crossed my mind with one handsome professor was like 5 years younger than I, you know, this sort of thing. So anyway, take it away. Tell us a little bit about the film, Dale.
Well, you're very right. It is a romantic drama that stars Sharon Lawrence and Nicholas Gonzalez. And Sharon is well known for NYPD Blue was where she got her big start. But she has been a television and film and really a stage actress. She's acted at the ensemble several times. Or at least twice she's acted there. She's an exceptional actress. And so this is a story, as you said, it's about a romance between, they're two grown-ups. This is not he's a younger than she is, but he's a grown man. He's almost 40, and she's, you know, like 52. But it's like a workplace romance, but in an environment where it is absolutely verboten to have any relationships between professors and students, and it has become, there have been multiple lawsuits, there's the Me Too movement, there's the tightening of Title IX rules, and so it is absolutely not okay to have really almost a platonic relationship, let alone a sexual relationship, with someone for whom you have a supervisory role. And so, and she's a philosopher professor and believes absolutely in the rules, but she's a rationalist. So to her, you know, the rules make sense, but little by little, she finds herself falling for this man, despite her better reason.
What was your impetus? What gave you this thought?
Well, interesting. I think it started way back when I was at UCSB and was a French major at the time and studied a Racine story about a forbidden love affair between an older woman and a man. And they did. It was about this pull between heart and reason. And so years later, I wrote what was called Dialectics of the Heart, which is a play. I've been a playwright for months.
Oh, yeah, we covered that, yes.
Yeah, so Dialectics of the Heart was done in Los Angeles with these same two actors. So when years later, I decided to age up the characters and re-examine in a period of time now where it's even more difficult for these relationships to happen, I brought them back into the project, and luckily they said yes, which is, they've had such blossoming careers since we did the play together. It was wonderful that they did come on board for this low-budget film, you know, that I produced myself and, you know, so and wrote and directed. So I was very pleased. that they were.
It doesn't look low budget at all.
It doesn't look low budget, and that is because I live in Santa Barbara, and in Santa Barbara, people are so generous. So many of those gorgeous locations that I have in the film were donated. And that alone, the Black Sheep, they, you know, we went in and used the Black Sheep restaurant. We used a professor's home for 4 days to be Elizabeth's home. We had Riviera Park and Santa Barbara City College. We had City College we paid, but even they gave us a nice, you know, a nice rate. And everyone was so generous. And those locations alone make the film's production value just soar. And then we also were lucky to have a multi-Grammy nominated composer to compose the music for the film. So the music is lush and beautiful. And of course, the acting all around, our entire cast is superb.
And what's the future? Tell me when I can look forward to seeing the whole thing.
Well, we are in what is called the film festival circuit at this point. We have just begun submitting. We are crossing our fingers that we will get to premiere at the Santa Barbara International Film Festival, which is where I would like to have my premiere. So I won't hear until January, but if it happens, that would be where we would premiere. Then there are multiple festivals that I've applied to as well, and so we will be on a festival circuit for about a year. After which I have someone working for me who's going to help arrange distribution, and we would go into the more general release of the film. So that's the plan.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, I want to have you on to talk about this at length.
Sure thing.
I really do, Dale, and I really appreciate you coming along and telling me the progress so far. And yes, fingers crossed for the Santa Barbara. I mean, I don't know how they can say no to it, because it's just, you know, it's compelling. It's sexy. It's got our own, you know, stamp of Santa Barbara all over it. So,
it
you know, I think it's fantastic. And you
so
know,
much.
Before this next week is over, let's get together and plan a time when we can actually really talk about the film. Don't turn that dial. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking about the Ensemble Theater Company's work right now. What we'll do now is maybe you can help me, Dale. I want to introduce a play that's, I mean, I've been trying to get you guys on for 2 weeks now. And this is a play at Ensemble Theater Company right now. You got to rush to see it, because it started the run December 3rd, and the end of the run is December 21st. So we kind of have to all get out there and get our tickets. I've got two performers that we're going to speak to today. Kirsten Hoy is with us, and Dale, I'd like for you to introduce Kirsten, please.
You'd like me to introduce her?
I will. I want to hear what you had to say to her before we came on the air.
I was actually saying that I go to all of UCSB student drama performances, because the drama department there is magnificent. And in fact, two of the actors in my own film I pulled from the drama department. They're smaller roles, but I went up to them and said, would you like to be in a feature film? So this is how impressed I am with the drama department over there, run by Risa Brainin, and why am I going blank on one of my closest friends, Abel? Talk to me.
Annie Torsiglieri?
No, not Annie Torsiglieri, although she's fabulous too. Irwin Abel, Irwin Apple. Yeah, I was going Abel because I have a friend who's an Abel. Irwin Apple, whom I know very well, and yet went blank. Any rate, they run a magnificent program there, and I did in fact see this young lady in a production.
You're talking about Kristen Hoy right
I'm
now.
Talking about Kristen Hoy, and I saw her in a production as. And as I am wont to do, I actually went up to her and told her how impressed I was with her acting. So that's how I'll introduce. If you want to go further, Elizabeth, please.
No, that's what I wanted to hear. It's so interesting how, you know, one of the questions, Dale, that I often put to people who are more senior people in the arts and also have had either directorial or teaching positions, my main question, you know, because I study connoisseurship and I'm an appraiser, and I also study the creative process, and, you know, I've been working in my line of work for 30 years. And I always ask people that have seniority in the performing arts, how do you recognize talent?
Oh, it is instinctive.
Okay, so that's one way of putting it. There's different theories on this. So, you know, there's the theory, I like to say that there's two main theories that so far in all the interviews that Richard and I have taken together for this program, it's a question that we often ask people. There's the Hemingway belief that talent is honed by work, and it's called the butt in chair school of thought. And, you know, that's how talent happens. He was a writer. So, you know, butt in chair, that's how. And if he had to look at a blank sheet of paper for 5 years, he did. So that's the one school of thought. The other school of thought is the more voodoo style, where the muses, or Greek, I should say, the muses come and sit on your head. And you have no really way of knowing when the muse is going to come and sit on your head. And you also don't know when the muse is going to leave the top of your head.
I will say I'm a proponent of both. Being a long-term writer, you have to put your butt in the chair. And I will say that talent, in my mind, is something that you're often born with, but it has to be worked, developed, honed, trained. And I will tell you that one of the reasons I recognize talent is because they've done all of that. And I'm sure these two young actors here have done all of that.
Yes. And I want to introduce them a little more further because I have their bios in front of me here. But yeah, it is interesting. I'll tell you, Dale and Kyle and Kristen, is Kirsten.
Yes.
I want to tell you, we've got this really great painter in town. And Richard and I have interviewed him a number of times, and he's taught for almost 50 years. And I don't know if you have any experience with painting in oil, but oil, I think one of you is an artist, isn't that right?
I've done acrylics. I picked it up during the pandemic, so I can't claim in any way to know the rigors of true painting.
Kyle is a wonderful artist, I can attest.
Okay. Well, then even with acrylic, you get this, you'll get this joke or this aphorism. Mm. So Michael Drury, longtime painter, longtime teacher. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do you recognize talent? And, you know, you're going around and you're doing your judging and you're critiquing as you go through the class. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, I stand in front of this easel and that easel and this easel and that easel. And I recognize talent right before that person paints the brown potato in the sky. What that means is when you overwork something in oil or even in acrylic, you get mud.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
And so his take on talent after teaching for 50 years was that it's fairly raw and fairly immediate, and you got to know when to stop.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, Hokusai, the Japanese.
Yeah.
Right?
Woodblock artist, yes.
Age, he said something along the lines of, you know, when I'm 100, I'll finally know how to paint. And it's about taking away more than continuing to add.
Yeah. Now, okay, so first of all, I want to introduce a little bit. So this is a play at, and please, Dale, stay on and help me because you've been so fantastic so far. This is a play called The Complete Works of Jane Austen Abridged. What that means is there was four separate writers, Dale, and they wanted to take all of the four, we have the incredible works of the writer, Pride and Prejudice, Emma, what else am I forgetting?
Ooh, that's one of my lines. I can take that.
Yeah, go for it.
Pride and Prejudice, Sense and Sensibility, Northanger Abbey, Emma, Mansfield Park, and Persuasion.
Ooh,
There
all of
you
them. They're
go.
doing all of them. Oh my goodness. So
Including
got
the
all we've got all those wonderful works, and what the premise of this play is, and I was looking at some of the critics' awards about the play, is that the four writers were charged, or charged themselves, with this concept of let's abridge Jane Austen and let's make it when it's a great love story, but it's a funny great love story. And I was looking at some of the photos of your production for you two, Kyle and Kristen, and I was looking and seeing how very true to the period, Regency period, both the sets and the costumes are. And what's my background so that I am qualified to say that. So I worked for years, and how I got into appraising was I did verisimilitude for theaters. So I worked at ACT, I worked at the Guthrie, I worked at get the Geffen. I worked at a lot of different theaters, and they'd hire me to do period consulting. So they'd say, okay, we want to do an Ibsen play. What does it look, what does Biedermeier in 1840 look like? And so they, what do the, what, what's the, what is the tableware like? What's the, what are the costumes like, et cetera. So I got into appraising because I knew so much about period historical design. And I was wondering, okay, so you've got the play, The Complete Works of Jane Austen Abridged. Your costumes are absolutely true.
Yes,
And
designed by the
yeah.
fabulous Abra Flores.
Yes, she did a
They're
beautiful job.
incredible. They're like
I
all
looked into her.
beautiful.
Yes, I looked into her. I was so impressed with that. I looked into, and I just have to say, so you are listening. If you're listening on the radio, you're listening, but you can't see Kyle's extremely handsome period mutton chops.
Oh, yeah. His,
True, it's true.
the work of a couple of months here.
Right, and that's totally period as well,
Yes.
down to the facial hair. So I think that's really impressive. But now, I guess my so we have a balance here. We have 20th century humor, but we have early 19th century verisimilitude.
Yeah,
Okay.
because the conceit of the play is that basically these two actors, Kirsten here and Alyssa, who's not here right now, are two huge super Jane Austen fans, and so they decide to put on a play for everybody where they're going to do all the complete works, and one of their actors who they hired to play all the men drops out at the last minute. And so they're frantically trying to think about, oh my God, how are we going to do this? How are we going to do this? And I wander into the theater, being completely ignorant of anything about Jane Austen,
But you've
but
got a
just,
silk costume.
yeah, I rented a costume. I was like, I need an acting job really bad. I'm just going to go in there and give it my best shot. And I managed to finagle my way into letting them be in the play. But I also get to, and dramaturgically, I function sort of as a way in for the audience for who might not be as familiar with Jane Austen's works.
So I think
I
the
see.
Reason the set and the costumes are so period accurate is because the character I play and the character Alyssa plays, like, truly understand everything about Jane Austen. They know the stories back and forward, and they've decided to put this together because they want to share, like, their massive love of Jane Austen with the audience. And so we have these, like, very much like 21st century people in this, Austen land that they've created because they know it so well.
Well, okay, so I have a bunch of questions. Being a fan of Jane Austen myself, also love that period. And I'll have to show you a Regency piece that I have. It's a ladies' fan straight out of that period.
Oh, wow. Oh my God, it must be.
Yeah. And I'll get it down off my bedroom wall in a minute. But this is, it's interesting because this play is charming and honest. It's been reviewed to say the charm lies in its delicate negotiation between homage and parody. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my master's degree, I had to do a thesis, and I did it, my master's thesis, years and years ago, in period play acting. So you know how you have like the Mountain Men, and you have the Civil War reenactors.
Right.
And you have these reenactors, and so why I was a historian at the time, and what I was interested in was how accurate are the reenactors, and is there true motivation to be accurate, or is there true motivation to find themselves in the moment as character? So mm-hmm. do they become one with the period, or do they like skate on top of the waves of the period?
Yeah. I mean, something that's really interesting about this version of how we're engaging with Jane Austen is that I think it's coming from there's a little bit of that cosplay element to it for sure, but it's also very much about engaging with the humanity of the stories. Mm-hmm. You know, Kirsten has this beautiful speech about like, you feel like you're right there with Lizzie Bennet, you know, mm-hmm. because of how beautiful Austen's writing is and the power and the sort of universality of those stories, even though they happened, you know, they're taking place over 200 years ago. So I think it's about like underneath the corsets and underneath the stiff collars and the mutton chops are these people who are negotiating really difficult situations, and they're in love and they're angry at each other, and it's just all the things that make us human is so fun to engage with in this play particularly.
Yeah, I totally agree. Kyle actually said a student matinee this morning.
Oh yeah. Oh my God.
We had a student matinee this morning, and Kyle was answering a question with one of the students, and you said something that I really love, which is that like humans are humans no matter what time period they're in.
Yeah.
And so there's something like really lovely and freeing about that in the work that we're doing, because I think, you know, if people like aren't a Jane Austen fan, they've never read the book, they might have like a different perception of what that work really is.
Yeah.
And I think when I found out I got cast and I like reread the books and I was like, you know, reapproaching this work, I was like, oh, this is like really funny. Like even her writing, like, so not separate from our play, but like her writing, she's a really bright, intelligent, funny author that like is such a great observer of society and people. And so much of the work that we're doing is in like homage to that. And then it's also taking a very like fresh and fun look at the work as well. So each of the books kind of is approached in a different way in our show. And so some of them do kind of skate all along that surface like you were talking about. And then other ones are a little bit more grounded and then have like really like honest and true romantic moments that then like really quickly pop back into comedy. So I think the play is really just an exploration of all the dynamics that can exist within the Austen world.
Yeah.
Okay, so now both of you, Dale, I'm just going to surprise you a little bit. Dale Griffith Stamos is still with us. I asked her to stay. Her insight as a playwright, screenwriter is invaluable here. But Kyle has quite a history. Not only does he teach Shakespeare, but he teaches at a really prestigious school, the Art of Acting Studio in Hollywood and the Stedler Adler Studio in New York. He comes from UC San Diego, but also he has his BFA from NYU at Tisch. And not only that, it seems that there's a common thread of historicism that runs through some of the works that he's performed in. I mean, it goes from, you know, the 1500s to the 17 1800s to the 1800s to the 1900s, and then back again to this 15th century. And, you know, it's you've got a lot of period characters in your
Yeah, there's just something about me that makes people want to put me in a rough. And I remember when I I got my my first tattoo, I was like, oh my God, I'm an actor. Is this a horrible idea? And then I thought about what my career had been up to that point. And I was like, no one's ever asked to put me on stage in a t-shirt. I'm good. So like, I'm always covered up.
Collar, yeah. Vest.
So, but yeah, I do love period pieces. I've always been a big heightened language person, which is why I teach Shakespeare at the Art of Acting Studio, which is a great the sister school affiliate of the Stella Adler School in New York. And I think so. You know, it's so fun to work on this play because teaching Shakespeare to young actors, you know, in sort of a undergrad context, I'm thinking a lot about how we relate to writers that are far removed from us culturally in time, and what makes them still relevant, and how do we, you know, connect to the humanity of those characters. And I think this play engages with that in such a fun way. I'm going to tell a story that Kirsten's heard me told a million times.
I'm excited.
But I had such an experience actually with one time when I visited London and went to Westminster Abbey, and they have the Poets' Corner there, you know, where they have all the graves and monuments to the various great writers and artists throughout British history. And I turned around and there was Charles Dickens, you know, tombstone there. And all of a sudden I just got very, very emotional because I had read a lot of Charles Dickens' work. And there's an Indigo Girls song that talks about feeling a connection with Virginia Woolf. It's like, you know, it's like a telephone line through time, and the feeling of connecting with another person across space and across time, and feeling like they've understood something about you, or that they've helped you through a hard time in your life. And I think the main impulse of the play is to say thank you to figures like that in the arts, who mm-hmm. like Jane Austen or Charles Dickens or Shakespeare, or whoever it may be. Is this play is just like a big, like, thank you. Thank you for writing these things. Thank you for being mm-hmm. with us still. I actually, Kirsten, in the last scene that you and Alyssa have, there's a discussion about what would Jane think of us now, right?
Yeah. I we have this whole dialogue at the very end, and Alyssa asks me, like, do you think she'd be happy with us mm-hmm. and what we've done? And my answer is that, like, I don't know. I think so. I think she'd be psyched that her stories and the women in them are still so loved. Mm. And, you know, she couldn't have the fame in her lifetime, but all of us, including the people in the audience, are all still here. And we're still talking about her words and her characters and the way that it's impacted us, you know, 250 years after her birth. And so there's something really special about that. And I'm a big reader. I think Kyle, you're a big reader.
Yeah.
So like for people like us who love books in general and have always like felt a big connection to literature. Mm. I mean, and Alyssa, not to speak for her, but she was an English literature major in college.
Yeah.
So like all of us have this like really deep connection to books and to reading. And so to get to do a play where we play people who just like truly unabashedly love reading and literature and they're excited to share how it's shaped their lives. Like that's just been such a fun treat.
Yeah.
I think for us.
Yeah.
So how do you get away from this, Kyle, especially you, because you were talking about, you know, picking up on Dickens' ghosts in the Poet's Corner there. And, you know, and then you do so many, I notice in your background, lots of British theater.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury's out. So my son's father, we met in grad school in Britain, mm-hmm. and we've been friends ever since. And he is decidedly British, has a very heavy British accent, mm-hmm. and he always kind of makes fun of Americans performing in a British historical play. What do you feel about that?
Well, I can say the same thing that I have seen a play in London with English actors doing American accents, and they were, I think they sound to a native ear, as in like an English native ear, the accent sounds fine, but as a Native American English speaker, I was like, that's not a sound that we make. So I'm sure there's all sorts of things that are inaccurate. You do the best you can and hope that no one is too hard on our poor pity the poor players,
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is a little bit of snobbery because you say it cuts both ways. I was l listening to or watching the movie Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I just love that film, and of course the lead is British. Winslet is British, and she does a darn fine American accent, but you can really hear that she's not American, and nobody faults her for that. But if we do that on the opposite side of the pond, we get into trouble. I also think that you were talking about picking up on old energies, and I was looking at your background, Kyle. I was thinking, okay, this is some relationship, this man I'm going to interview, some relationship to Nathaniel Hawthorne, because of course the famous Hester Prynne in A Scarlet Letter is Hester. And I was thinking, oh, I wonder if there's any kind of connection there, why he's picking up on all these wonderful, classical historical characters. Have you ever thought about such a thing?
Well, when I was in high school and we were reading The Scarlet Letter, certainly I heard about it then.
And then isn't Arthur Miller's play The Crucible, isn't there a Hester? Isn't she one of the main characters in The Crucible as well?
You may be
I'm
right.
thinking,
Long since I've encountered, since I've really engaged with that play again.
Well, at any rate, I'm off target here, but I was just thinking, wow, there's a lot of historicism to your name as well. And then, Kirsten, your name, Danish?
Yes, Danish.
Okay, what's your background?
Like with my name, like where it comes from?
Yeah, your name, yeah.
So my dad is Danish, and his father came from Denmark. I've grown up with a lot of Hodge and Hoag, and one time even Hog, and that was an interesting
I
choice.
think I said who's
Yeah, he was a
first name.
huge.
I was like,
But I have this. There's a Scandinavian slash in the O, and hopefully that gives people a little bit of a pause. But it is pronounced hoy. And it means hill in Danish.
oh.
And then my first name is actually the name of my dad's aunt from Denmark. So I have a very Danish name.
Okay, all right. And then I just want to tell a little bit about your background, and that is that, right now you're in Los Angeles, but you grew up in Ojai. And of course, as Dale was saying, a BFA in acting from UC Santa Barbara. She's done a lot of really interesting theater, Below Zero at the Hollywood Fringe, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein at Indiana Rep. Oh, I remember Indiana Rep. So I actually, my son's father, Adrian, who is the British guy I was telling you about, he went for a BFA and was in theater management and at the University of Indiana. So I know the theater real well. Prague Shakespeare Company, Macbeth, Margaret of Anjou. I think I saw that production
Yeah,
at
Sheeple,
UCSB.
UCSB. It was a launchpad.
Twelfth Night and Seagull. Well, I can see you in Seagull for sure. And then she's a literary person, Dale. She likes new plays. She likes reading new plays. She likes reading new playwrights.
Oh, don't worry. She's on my radar.
Okay.
And maybe after I see the show, Kyle, you will be too. So
We'll see.
we're seeing it towards
Okay.
the end of the run.
Oh, fun.
So Beth Henley, I knew her in her way back beyond years kind of lost track of her, but another incredible writer, director. So the written word, important to Kristen, very important to Kristen. And I want to also know a little bit about your director. I was not aware of your director, and I thought, well, Jesus is a person to be reckoned with. Robert Kelly, artistic director, emeritus of theater works in Silicon Valley. He founded that in 1970. Mm-hmm. He won the regional theater Tony Award in 2019 after producing almost 200 productions for the theater. He's directed five previous Jane Austen stage productions, including world premiere of musicals like Pride and Prejudice and Emma. He directed at Cincinnati Playhouse. I'm very familiar with them too, and at Playhouse in the Park, yeah, and the Repertory Theater of St. Louis. I'm very familiar with them. And he did Christmas at Pemberley, which I think, did you perform in that, Kyle, as well?
Yeah, it's a trilogy written.
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm thinking here. Okay, go ahead.
It's a trilogy of sort of elevated fan fiction, I guess you could say, because they're excellent plays. And by Lauren Gunderson and Margot Melkon, I believe. But they sort of essentially picture in, you go to Christmas every year at Pemberley, and they picture sort of the other Bennett sisters from Pride and Prejudice getting married off. And Ensemble Theater Company here did the second one, which focuses on Lydia and Mr. Wickham. Mm-hmm. And I played Mr. Wickham in that about 3-4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is it like working with a director who's had at least five Austen credits to his name and a musicology kind of background?
Yeah.
What does he bring?
He brings a extremely thorough, detailed knowledge of Jane Austen to the process, down to the, like, this is how they fold the letters, this is the cut of the coat, this is, like, mm-hmm, it was really, really impressive, and helped our process a lot in terms of finding the balance, like you were talking about a little earlier, mm-hmm, about between the silliness and the modernness, because we're playing, mm-hmm, actors in the 21st century playing these roles, but then making sure that as we enter into the storytelling parts of the show, that we're being faithful as possible to, you know, the spirit of Austen.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to hear the subtext in what you're saying, which is, so my sister, Nan, is a SAG actress in New York, and she has a theory of directors, and she's, some directors don't let her do anything she wants to do. And, you know, she'll come up with an idea and she gets so frustrated because the director will be, you know, don't get out of line. I'm telling you, you know, where your mark is and what your line is going to be and this sort of thing. And then there's other directors that just sort of sit there and let the actor kind of be creative. And she hates both of those.
Oh, okay. Well,
type of directors.
That sounds... Sounds
because
different.
You know, one is too freeing and one is too restrictive.
Yeah.
And so,
as
you know,
a director, I will add that there is an in between to those two extremes.
Right.
And that's where I play, is in that in between.
No, I mean, our rehearsal room was like a clown show every day.
We had so much
fun. We're just all trying to make each other laugh. And so, like, and Cal, it was like a, ideas came from everywhere. You know, Kelly had lots of great ideas about, oh, I think actually, you know, what you're doing there might be a little more funny if you just hold a little longer, or, you know, because comedy is very, very precise.
Yes.
You know, it's and I think it was always just about, like, whatever makes us laugh the most wins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes
that's surprising because, you know, this is a Tony Award winning director, you know, that you would think would be a little more strict with his rehearsal room. But no, you're saying he enjoyed you guys.
I think he fell in the middle. You know, yeah.
I will say he brought a level of like very clear specificity about the time period and about our accuracy in terms of like our beautiful set that we have and all of our props and our costumes. There's only a few modern props, and like their presence is very funny because of the contrast with the rest of the
Yeah,
piece.
yeah. And we can't contribute anything about the process. I don't know anything
And
about
so I
that.
will say like his he had just a clear vision for what the piece would be, which was so lovely to like walk into the space and have that. And then the three of us, Alyssa included, we all did such like I think a level of work before starting the process too. And so I think everyone came in with like a really clear understanding of who they were, what they were doing, and then the collaboration really began like once we were in the room. And I think the process really ended up with something really lovely at the end.
So I tell you what we're going to do is we'll go to a very quick break so I can grab my fan and show you my Regency fan. And Richard wants to go to a quick break when we get back from the break. Gail, think of a couple of questions from your where you're sitting as a director. What would you be looking for? And I just have to say, I would be interested knowing, I'm such a clothes horse. I would be interested in knowing, one of my questions is when you put those gowns on, the Regency period is all empire, it's all up. And so the shoulders are puff and there's a high bust line, sometimes cross the bust line. And it's very, I mean, there's stories of people in 1813 freezing. Because they did all they wanted to wear was their beautiful cotton gowns, but they didn't want to wear like a heavy wrap because that wasn't the look. So they'd be out there freezing to death. So I'm thinking, how did the clothes become you? How did the clothes help you become your role? And let's go to a quick break, Richard. I'll grab that thing, and when we get back from the break, Dale's going to ask a question, and then we're going to talk about clothes, my favorite subject. Don't turn that dial. Welcome back. It's Elizabeth Stewart. I'm talking about the Ensemble Theatre Company's work right now, and you got to rush and get your tickets. December 21st is the last show, The Complete Works of Jane Austen, and I am speaking with two of their stars, Kyle T. Hester and Kirsten Hoge. And
Boy.
Dale Stamos, who's a well-known filmmaker, is helping me in this interview. And Dale, I wanted you to have the opportunity to ask these stars a question. Go ahead.
When I work with actors, first of all, I trust their instincts first and foremost. And so one of my questions was that Kirsten, you said that you had done a lot of work in advance of coming together for the actual rehearsal process. So what kind of work was that that you did?
I think all three of us did a lot of work with our the script, and so like I came in almost off book, and so and 5 days into the process, we were up and running off book, like running the whole show. And so doing all that prep makes the process just much easier on my end, and I feel like it kind of frees you from like being stuck in a page, and then you can really make choices and bring your full embodiment to the character. And also because of the nature of the show, each of us plays around 11 or 12 characters. And we also do silly voices and all of these things. And especially because there's accent work involved as well. A lot of the prep that I did, where that was concerned, was just reading through the script and like kind of deciding in my head, and also like working on it beforehand of like what are these voices going to sound like? And of course, we're working within the constraints of like received pronunciation, but every character has its own affect as well. And so, that has to do with like vocal posture and pitch and rate and tone. And every character sounds a little different. And so I think a lot of that work was done on the front end, which meant that we had a lot more freedom in the space to really like see what that would look like when we put it all together.
Yeah, it's so like you said, we're playing so many characters. You can't, at least I can't anyways. You you have to come in with some ideas. And some of the, especially for, characters that for so many people, some people, you know, might not know Mansfield Park, but like a lot of people know who, or have an idea in their head of like who Lizzie Bennet is and who Mr. Darcy is like. So you have to honor that in some way, and also try and put your own personal spin on it as an actor, but also in some ways you're homaging the movies that people love. Like yes. one of my characters I play, Colonel Brandon in Sense and Sensibility, and played by Alan Rickman in the movie. Yes. And it's very clearly specified in the script that my character is doing Alan Rickman from that movie. And that was, you know, so that was a thing I had to work on, try and figure that out.
I think that's really kind of interesting, because I was almost going to say Winona Ryder, how much did she influence this production? Because I just thought, you know, didn't she perform in one of the
Prejudice?
Yeah.
Was she in? I think she was one of the. There's so many Lizzies in so many Pride and Prejudices.
Yeah. So how much did the previous performances, you know, and now what Kyle is saying is that the play's taken that and running with it and making it a joke, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Kirsten has a line where she says, you know, half the reason people
read the book is because they watched the movie first.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's so many, that's just people's way in. And sometimes even in a way that I think is really lovely, because it speaks to the larger sort of Austin universe, where what people, when people are thinking of these characters, what they're really remembering is like moments from the movies or from the BBC series or something that moved them or excited them.
Yeah.
So it's always sort of about like what's the books and also the movies, and then also just, you know, the whole world of fan fiction and cosplay that's out there for the Jainites, who we've had a couple, at almost every show, we've had like
some tried and true fans.
Yeah. Sometimes people are dressed up, which is so fun, but there's always people that, you know, like during the less popular works, there's always someone who like gets really excited that we're doing Mansfield Park or that we're doing Sanditon, or, you know, so that's really fun.
Yeah.
Well, I gotta say, this has been so enlightening to me, and thank you both for coming on. And Kyle T. Hester playing Trevor, and of course Kirsten Hoge and her wonderful performance. And there's another woman that we have to credit as well, another of our stars,
Alyssa Ann Austin.
Yes. Okay. And so we thank you all for being here. Dale, we got to get together again, and thank you for helping me with this. And that's fantastic, guys. I look forward to it. And just very quickly, Kyle, what's your next deal? What's your next gig?
I'm going back to LA and enjoying the holidays.
There you go. And Kristen, how about you?
That's the next thing on my plan as well. And, you know, as it always is for us actors, just lots of auditions. Please, and
start the hustle again.
Working for the next one.
All right. Well, thank you all. Thanks, Richard. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Lovely to meet you.
Bye, guys.
Bye. Nice to see you.